my happy home to see what I could find out. I left my folk and friends with the aim to clear my mind out. Hit the roundy road, many kinds I met there, many stories told me all of the way to get there. Ooh. So on and on I go, the seconds tick, the time out, there's so much left to know when I'm
Welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling on KKRN 88.5 FM. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Unspun tries to unravel the hype and illusions of corporate media through in-depth interviews with truth-tellers and advocates from around the world. Excuse me. We are now streaming live on the internet. Go to kkrn.org, click on the Listen button. Unspun is a call-in show, so we invite our listeners to call in if you have any questions or comments for our guests or for me. Our number in the studio is 530-337-1885, 530-337-1885. You can also send me an email at unspun@kkrn.org. Today, our guest is Professor Harvey J. Kay. Professor Kay is the Ben and Joyce Rosenberg Professor of Democracy and Justice Studies at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. He's an award-winning author. He has published 15 books on history, politics, and ideas, contributed articles and essays to a diverse array of publications, including The Washington Post, The Daily Beast, Salon.com, Huffington Post, and he has appeared as a guest on numerous television and radio shows, including Bill Moyer's Journal, Book TV, Afterword, and Here and Now, and The Tom Hartman Show, which we carry here on KKRN in the afternoons. He was born in New Jersey, like myself. He received a BA at Rutgers in 1971 and his MA at the University of London in 1973 and his PhD at Louisiana State University in 1976. He is a member of the National Writers Union, AFT, and PEN, and an Organization of American Historians Distinguished Lecturer from 2007 to 2013. Professor Kay lives with his wife, Lorna, in Green Bay, Wisconsin, where they raised two daughters and root for the Packers. His newest book is The Fight for the Four Freedoms, What Made FDR the Greatest Generation Truly Great. You can follow him on Twitter at Harvey J. Kay. Kay is spelled with an E on the end, K-A-Y-E. Links to his books and articles and appearances will be on our website along with the archives of this show. Professor Kay, welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling.
Thanks. It's great. The only thing better is if I was looking at you in the studio.
Well, that would be more fun for us, too. We were reminiscing before we went on air about life growing up in the 50s and 60s and how different that was. And I noticed, I know what you would attribute it to, and I think I would too, FDR, the New Deal. But a lot of younger folks and even a lot of older folks don't even know our own history. So I thought maybe we could start there, maybe talking about growing up in that era and what the New Deal had to do with that prosperity we were enjoying.
That's a really good place to start, in fact. And the first thought that comes to my mind is this. When I was a kid, I was born in 1949 in Englewood, New Jersey, and we spent some time in New York City, but mostly in northeastern New Jersey. When I was growing up, it was this time of, you know, growth and to use the old line, you know, the old term, great expectations. And one of the things that I remember, and this is very telling of I think the greatest generation, my father's and mother's generation. My father was a veteran, a wounded veteran and decorated veteran of World War II. One of the things that I remember is that when there were school referenda, like, you know, should we build a new school, should we add something to it, whatever it might be, one of the things my father and my mother said on separate occasions, but both said it, is that when education's on the agenda, we vote for it. And that was one of the things that you know, at the time struck me. And only much later did I really come to appreciate what that reflected. And I think it reflected this. You know, in 1929, into the early 1930s, the Great Depression struck and got deeper and deeper. And in 1932, Franklin Roosevelt ran for president on what he called the New Deal agenda, which included a series of public initiatives, the possibility of creating Social Security, the enabling of folks to organize in a democratic fashion. I mean, it was a New Deal agenda. And in the course of the 30s, however slow it may have been in getting out of that depression, that generation that would go on to fight in World War II and then come back to rebuild America and literally to transform it into the most prosperous nation in history, they saw what was possible when Americans are mobilized and when they harness democratic government to combat the evils and ills that afflict them. And central to a lot of that were a series of really important educational initiatives. The CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps, that addressed soil erosion and deforestation and all of that, millions of young men took part in it. Central to that was an educational process. They were all taught skills, and they were taught ideas. And in many ways, it's that generation that truly launches what will later become the environmental movement. So anyhow, when I think about growing up, when you mentioned that, because we didn't talk exactly where we'd start, the first thing that kicked off in my head was what my father and mother had said to me about, when education's on the agenda, we support it. Now, when they went off to war and they came back, there were a whole series, again, a lot of Americans don't know this, even during the war there were educational initiatives. FDR was convinced that America would win the war. But he was convinced as well that to truly win the war, you had to prepare a generation for the challenges of the post-war years. And even before they enacted the GI Bill of Rights that enabled 12 million young American men and women to equip themselves to carry on American development after the war, he had initiated during the war something called the ASTP, the Army Specialized Training Program. And I came to know about this because of my father. My father would rarely talk about the war experience, but one of the badges that I found in the house was a badge that was really quite handsome. It was gold with blue trim and a blue Aladdin's lamp and a sword through it. And what the ASTP was, this Army Specialized Training Program, is they recruited, once these men had entered the service, 350,000 of them. And by the way, I think it ended up an additional 100,000 or so in the Navy, to go through educational training, not simply military training, but literally to get basic degrees in engineering and art, in a whole series of technical and scientific fields. Now, eventually, they broke up the program because they needed the men for combat. But these were, you know, almost 500,000 young men who had been trained in a fashion with skills and technical abilities, who then, add to that the GI Bill of Rights, this generation was prepared educationally. And I emphasize this because we live at a time right now, if you think about it, I know I'm going on a bit, but I'll just, you know, segue a bit. We live at a time in which education is once again, at least in too many states that once took great pride in their educational system, is under siege. Here in Wisconsin, teachers' unions have been busted by the Republicans under Scott Walker. Higher education has been slashed. The funding for higher education has been slashed. These Republicans have absolutely no respect for the legacy of the generation that they claim was so important, the greatest generation. So I know I took us away from it, but you kicked that memory off.
No, I think you're going down a path we need to go down. You talk about the four freedoms, and I actually have a clip from January 1944, which is a clip of FDR, our president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And he talks about a second Bill of Rights. So he was prepared to put something in place. I think this was about a year before he died. Let me play this.
I just want to say one thing.
Mm-hmm.
This was this idea of a second Bill of Rights. Roosevelt had this in his mind from the day he took office. Just to note, in 1932, he called during the campaign for an economic declaration of rights, that is, standing on the idea of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And then there's the four freedoms in January 41. And then this, in many ways, is that sort of the vision for right after the war. You go ahead, then. Yeah.
Real quickly, as a segue into that, what are the four freedoms? Because people need to understand that, too, when I play this.
Okay, I'll do this quickly. The four freedoms, which he pronounced in January 41, in the year before we entered the war, were freedom of speech and expression, freedom of worship, those two clearly within the Bill of Rights. The third was freedom from want, which is central to so many aspirations and struggles of Americans for more than 200 years, and freedom from fear. So freedom of speech, freedom of worship, freedom from want, freedom from fear, which is then articulated all the more in the tape you're going to play.
All right, here that is, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, January 1944. I'm hoping. Here it is.
In our day, certain economic proofs have become accepted as self-evident. A second Bill of Rights, under which a new basis of security and prosperity can be established for all, regardless of station or race or creed. Among these are the right to a useful and remunerative job, the right to earn enough to provide adequate food and clothing and recreation, the right of every farmer to raise and sell his products at a return which will give him and his family a decent living, the right of every businessman, large and small, to trade in an atmosphere of freedom, freedom from unfair competition and domination by monopolies at home or abroad, the right of every family to a decent home, the right to adequate medical care, and the opportunity to achieve and enjoy good health, the right to adequate protection from the economic fears of old age, sickness, accident, and unemployment, the right to a good education. All of these rights spell security. And after this war is won, we must be prepared to move forward in the implementation of these rights to new goals of human happiness and well-being. For unless there is security here at home, there cannot be lasting peace in the world.
That's FDR, 1944, talking about the Second Bill of Rights. What great concepts. Where did we go wrong? How did we get all of this has basically, since Truman, as far as I can tell, have been backed out of. They're trying to back out of all of these things, most of the conservative forces and elite that are ruling America right now. So where did we go wrong, Professor
Kay? Before we get, it's a sad story in many ways, but we shouldn't forget that in the 60s there was a greater fulfillment of that vision of FDR's by way of Medicare and Medicaid and a number of other massive initiatives as part of the Great Society. But it is a good point. I mean, what went wrong? I mean, the first thing that people should realize is that when FDR made that speech, when he offered that speech and laid out the vision of an economic Bill of Rights, he didn't do it hoping Americans might be interested in the proposition. He actually knew from polls that had been conducted in the previous 12 months that Americans themselves already endorsed the fundamentals of that economic Bill of Rights. For example, 94% of Americans endorsed the expansion of Social Security in old age pensions. 84% believed in job insurance, basically what we would think of as unemployment insurance being expanded. 83% endorsed national health coverage, national health insurance. 79% endorsed aid for students, and 73% supported the idea of work relief. That is, if there isn't a job, there will be public initiatives to assure full employment. That's significant. I mean, that includes both Democrats and Republicans. And the breakdown was often that if Democrats endorsed it in the low 90%, Republicans weren't that far behind, perhaps around 80%. So this was a fairly universal endorsement that he knew he had before he even spoke those words. Now, what went wrong? Well, during the war, actually in 1942, Republicans had not taken control of Congress, but if you put together the Republicans in Congress and the Southern Democrats, who on many a question were decidedly conservative, and what made them conservative was their fear that Roosevelt was going to pursue the end of Jim Crow, that he was actually going to seek some kind of integration. I mean, people criticized the Roosevelt administration for not doing a number of things during the New Deal years and the war, but everyone knew that given opportunities, the Roosevelt administration might well pursue the end of Jim Crow, the end of white supremacy. And when Southern Democrats imagined national health insurance, let's take that as the most significant of all, they said, no, we won't support it, because they presumed that it would entail desegregating Southern hospitals. And they did not want blacks and whites in the Southern hospitals. So after the war, Roosevelt passed away in May of 1945, and Truman became president, having been the vice president in that last year. What happens is Truman, he decides he's going to pursue the Second Bill of Rights. He actually makes a national address in which he speaks directly to that. And in particular, he wants to enact a national health care program. Well, the Southern Democrats and the Republicans, as much as they didn't like each other, they were more than willing to stand together to block that kind of initiative. And believe me, they were serious when they said they did not want to desegregate. And don't forget, African Americans at that time, the majority of them did not have the vote in the South, so there was no way of weakening that Southern white supremacy Democrat, soon to be Dixiecrat, party. Well, so the Democrats, in essence, are split, and Roosevelt knows even himself that he can't get this enacted. But what he is hoping is that after the war, the Democrats might, the Northern Democrats, and perhaps even persuade a cast of Southern Democrats who believed in the New Deal but had to worry about the question of white supremacy. Well, as we look at the Democratic Party over the ensuing years, what we find is that until Johnson, in particular, not Kennedy so much, but until Johnson, as much as they mouthed a commitment to many of these things, it wasn't really until Johnson that they're placed first and foremost on the political agenda. And then, of course, we have the Great Society Initiative. The Great Society Initiative, for all of its failings, was indeed the redemption, in many ways, of the New Deal and that vision of the economic Bill of Rights. We should also not fail to remind everyone that the GI Bill of Rights, which was enacted, really did include many of those things, at least on a temporary basis, to the millions of young Americans who fought in the war. The GI Bill is probably the greatest public welfare program in American history, and clearly, radically the most successful, right?
Yeah, let me interrupt for a second to remind our listeners, you're listening to Unspun, an Experiment of Truth. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Professor Harvey J. Kay is with us on the phone for the hour. We're discussing American history and its value for us today, mainly the lessons of the New Deal and what has happened since. So our call-in number here is 530-337-1885, 530-337-1885. We invite your questions and comments. So, Professor Kay, you're talking about socialism. Am I right?
Well, I don't call it socialism, because I often envision socialism as a more aggressive form in which working people themselves have a greater control over the economy. But I think this is clearly what the Europeans call social democracy, and I think that's pretty much what FDR was about, even when he didn't use the term. And I also think that's pretty much what we've seen in a number of announcements, pronouncements during this campaign. And I think the one who most embodies that kind of FDR tradition is probably, you won't be surprised given our exchanges, Bernie Sanders. But obviously, other Democrats are trying to catch up and do the same.
Well, and I see these other Democrats, and I think much of I'm pretty much a cynic when it comes to our government. Much of our Congress is now bought and paid for, more or less. And so you see a defense of the what you refer to this as the center right by Democrats, who you would think would be more towards the populist leanings in our country, those percentages that you described before, there are still majorities that want those same things today and always have.
It's fascinating, isn't it? I mean, you're absolutely right. The bought and paid for is should not be discounted. You know, the Democratic Party never really gave up its liberal progressive rhetoric. But the fact is that how many people believed that even when Democrats were in the majority, they were going to pursue that kind of social democratic politics as aggressively as they had said in their platform speeches and campaign platforms. So I'm with you. I avoid this. Did you use the word cynicism? I never get cynical. I mean, as soon as I get cynical, I know it's all over. Then I might as well just turn around and go, you know, drive my car on a holiday.
Well, yeah, I border on apocalyptic, so you have to forgive me there. And anybody watching the stock market yesterday might agree with me.
I tweeted, you know, that I saw all that stuff, and I thought, you know, the way in which we sort of hang on this, I mean, one of the first things we need to do in any kind of social democratic politics is rein in the degree to which the stock market is going to frame our thinking.
Well, and certainly, because so much of what's happening in the stock market is not really a reflection of the economy or our social state of being.
No, clearly not. It often has more to do with questions of how much money are going into the pockets of the people holding the stock than it has anything to do with how much is going into the pockets of the people producing the wealth, right?
Well, certainly. We have the most inequality, I think, ever in our history now, which is pretty phenomenal if you think about what that means. It's pretty lopsided.
Yeah, so. I was writing yesterday. I'm putting together a new book proposal, and I was writing, and I was wondering if I should once again use the term Second Gilded Age. And I thought, well, if indeed we've outpaced the First Gilded Age in inequality, maybe we need a new term for what we're going through.
And a lot of it's driven by the same forces. Let me read part of a speech you gave at Yale in 2009. It was a month after President Obama's inauguration, and you said, quote, "We have experienced three decades of conservative ascendance and power, three decades in which well-funded conservative movements and ambitious and determined political and economic elites secured power and subordinated the public good to corporate priorities, enriched the rich at the expense of the working people, hollowed out the nation's economy and public infrastructure, and harnessed religion and patriotism to the pursuit of power and wealth. In short, we have endured 30 years of right-wing political reaction and class war from above intended to undo or undermine the progressive advances of the 30s and the 60s. And this was just a month after Barack Obama was inaugurated. And so my question for you, and I think a question we need to ask ourselves, I was hopeful when Barack Obama was elected. But that quickly changed when I saw that he basically turned the economy over to Goldman Sachs and General Electric. So my question, I guess, is in this progression or this regression that we're going through, what is your feeling or description of the Obama presidency? What's that going to look like looking back from the future as a historian? What do you think it's going to look like?
Well, let's start from the proposition that I've made over and over again, that is that Barack Obama is no Franklin Roosevelt. How's that? That's for a start, okay? Mm-hmm. I had questions. I wasn't so confident about Obama as many of my fellow citizens were, about his intent, his commitment to pursuing what you and I have been calling a social democratic kind of agenda. I didn't see his health care plans before he was elected as even anything near an FDR-style health care plan. It struck me that he was more than willing to create a health care plan that enriched the health insurance industry. At no point did he use the term universal, and to this day we still do not have a universal health care plan. So I had certain reservations, but I do admit that I was swept up on Inauguration Day, and I was in D.C. at the time. I was really swept up thinking just maybe, I'm underestimating the initiatives he intends to pursue. Now, one of the things that I think is really important, and I think this is the most telling thing about the Obama administration, the Obama presidency, is that when Roosevelt took office, everyone said, well, you know, Roosevelt had a real advantage. It was a depression. He could get away with doing things that would never have, you know. But the fact is that we were in deep crisis when Obama took office. The other thing was people are forgetting that the Democrats had retaken Congress 2 years before Obama was elected. And as I once said on Bill Moyer's show, it struck me that even before the 2008 elections, the Democrats ought to go on record saying their first item on the, of business is going to be universal health care, period, and then put it up as a vote in Congress to see what Republicans would do. And I figured in 2008 they would actually even get more seats in Congress. So imagine this. Roosevelt took office in 1933, and his first 100 days, you know, even if we can't imagine anyone reproducing that, those kinds of initiatives, it's important to realize that even the recovery bills that he enacted and others immediately sought to mobilize Americans and to empower them. And that's crucial when I say empower, because even in the recovery, National Industrial Recovery Act, it pronounced the right to organize on the part of working people into labor unions, the right to collective bargaining. And though there were troubles with that, they later turned around by way of Senator Wagner's initiatives in Congress and passed the National Labor Relations Act. So one of the things that Roosevelt knew is that when you call on Americans to vote for you, that's just the start. What you have to then do is you have to mobilize Americans to confront the challenges of the day and empower them to mobilize on their own and to organize. Now think about when Barack Obama took office. The first thing he did, I mean, it was pretty clear he was going to invest in this, in his Obamacare, as it came to be called. But what he did is he placed all of his efforts into negotiating with Congress, and especially with, I think it was two senators from Maine at the time. I mean, and supposedly he had learned his lesson from the Clintons, who did not negotiate with Congress. But they, neither one of them paid attention to what Roosevelt did, which is, again, to mobilize Americans. So what happened in the spring and summer of 2009? I mean, it's a rhetorical question. The ones who turned out in the public square was the Tea Partiers. Where was the labor movement? Why weren't labor unionists and civil rights activists and others turning out in the public square to endorse and support Obama's initiative? Why? Because Obama didn't call them out, and he didn't enable, he didn't empower. He actually turned his back on labor and decided he wouldn't support, because he figured he'd lose on the question, the EFCA, the Employee Free Choice Act. So I think the tragedy of the Obama administration is that if we imagine that he had intentions, grant him that, and he did indeed create something, a dramatic change in the health care arrangements in this country. But if we imagine what might have been, I think the great failing is that indeed he did not mobilize Americans who were ready to act. My students were ready to go. Unionists were ready to move. I mean, he didn't offer that invitation. He didn't reach out an arm and say, now is the time to move ahead. Roosevelt once said, a new law in itself does not create the millennium. Well, it's also the case that a new election in itself does not create the millennium. One other thing I want to... Can I jump again into the contemporary mood?
Certainly.
And the fact is, think about the candidates. I mean, look, the two leading candidates in the Democratic Party, I mean, there's the, you know, the mainstream candidate, Hillary Clinton, and there's the progressive candidate, Bernie Sanders. When you go and look at Bernie Sanders' speeches, a lot of policy initiatives, a lot of arguments and ideas regarding policy and programs. But one of the things that Bernie Sanders makes clear is that this requires more than just an election, that this is the beginning of a movement. He's got the sense that Roosevelt had, that the only way you make dramatic progressive change is you mobilize and empower your fellow citizens to do so. That's first. But then listen to when Hillary Clinton, who, by the way, I mean, this is not to knock her, but this is something people should attend to. The fact is, when she talks about her relationship to her fellow citizens, she says, I want to be your champion. Now, what does that mean? It means, yeah, I want to do this for you. But that's not the way you make progressive change. It's, here's what we need to do, and here's what you're going to have to do. That's what we need to hear.
Well, as you pointed out, you have to empower people. I mean, we can look at the people that Obama brought into the White House immediately. I think Jeffrey Immelt was supposed to – the CEO of General Electric was supposed to be the job czar. And I think the union representative quickly fell out of that committee because he realized – nothing was happening there. So there was no, as you say, empowerment under Obama. In fact, what there was hopes that he had created basically dashed. And so to me, the Obama administration, maybe looking 30, 40 years from now, if we still have a civilization, that you look back on this era as hopes dashed. And people more disempowered than before. In other words, that curve going back to the right that says people are the mob and therefore they're to be managed and controlled, that is becoming more the word, something that wouldn't have been tolerated after the Second World War, I don't believe.
Right. Well, in fact, although the initiative failed right after the war, I mean, after Roosevelt's death, there were a series of general strikes in some American cities. I mean, American workers were mobilized. Look, one of every three workers in the course of the 1940s and through the 50s was a member of a labor union. And they had no intention of allowing big business capital to ride roughshod over them as they had been doing in the 1920s after World War One. You know, there was a veteran named William Harlan Hale. He was an intelligence officer during the war. And right at the end of the war, he wrote a book titled The March of Freedom. Can I read a line or two from that?
We have a caller on the air. So one.
Oh, great. That's cool.
Oops.
That's great.
Well, I think we lost him. We did have a caller. Go ahead with your quote.
Well, he says in this book titled The March of Freedom, "All along our course, I thought I could see the same clash," as he's writing his book, "between those who had faith in the mass of men and those who feared them, between those who sought to extend opportunity and those who wanted to restrict privilege." And he said, you know, one thing that he's learned from his study of history, there is no limit to what the American people can do if they get together through the instrument of self-government and plan it. And he asked this question, 1946, why should we have to fall back? Why can't we do as we've done during these last dozen years, harness the powers of democratic government, curb the power of capital, create economic growth and development, end poverty, and enable people to advance themselves? Simple, straightforward, great, great understanding of what Americans at their best can do.
This, you know, it's interesting because I woke up with a dream this morning, and in the dream there was an abandoned farmhouse. And I thought about that, and I got online, and I went, you know what? How many farmers, and what was the makeup of America then compared to now? And what I discovered, and this may be a telltale thing about the American psyche or collective psyche, farmers were over 20% of the workforce in 1930. Today, they're less than 2% of the workforce, and mostly they're large agro-businesses. So and I guess my premise is those people had contact with life and the world and reality. And today, I don't think we have that same contact. We're removed from reality. We're not involved as those people were. The demographics are different. And I guess what I'm challenging is your idea that maybe Americans still have this. I don't know that they do.
Well, first of all, okay, I have this feeling you're living in a more rural area than mm-hmm. urban.
And more red.
And if that's the case, because I can tell you that reality strikes most Americans pretty hard most of the time, okay? It may not be the kind of natural reality that exists, say, you're in Northern California, right?
Yes.
And here I am in Wisconsin. But for most Americans, reality is pretty real, and what needs to be done is pretty demanding. So I don't know about if it's reality or not. I mean, you know, it's funny. I'm reading into your question, perhaps, but I want to write this new book, which basically stands with one leg in my earlier book, Thomas Paine and the Promise of America, and the other one stands firmly in this book on FDR and the Greatest Generation, the Fight for Four Freedoms. And it's really, I want to turn that article, that speech of mine you were quoting from before, I want to turn that into a book. Americans should embrace their radical history. Now, I want to make you hopeful, okay?
Okay.
You ready? imagine this, okay? And you've read this already yourself. Imagine this. What deep down in every American matters, okay? What's the vision of America that most Americans suppress but carry with them? I mean, it's probably an America of some kind of growth and development. It's probably an America in which freedom, equality, and democracy are fundamental. And if you walk, you know, I said this to a lot of people, go walk on the mall in Washington, D.C., you know, go close to where power and corruption reside, but then walk the mall and remember just what cannot be resisted in American life, you know. The monuments, which may seem like they're merely celebrating, you know, the greats, are also a testament to the rebelliousness and the radicalism that has always been at the heart of American life. And that's for a start. And I think that after these, what is now almost 40 years of right-wing, you know, predominance and ascendance, I think we're seeing great rumblings. You know, whether it's the Fight for 15, the Moral Monday movement in North Carolina, the enthusiasm for every time Elizabeth Warren speaks, the energy one experiences, and the size of the crowds at Bernie Sanders, the Black Lives Matter movement, which is challenging the Democrats themselves to once again become the party of justice, right?
Speaking,
it's all across the country this is happening.
Yeah, we speaking of rumblings, we have our caller back, so I want to take him and get him on the air and see what he has to say. Randy, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
You know, in this conversation about, you know, the Gilded Age and our nation being going through periods of the greatest prosperity in history, and speaking about how we're going to recreate that, you know, I think that there's a factor here that's not part of the conversation, and that is what all that was based on in the first place. Global prosperity, is it not based on the extraction and consumption of global resources, our finite natural resources? At this point, you know, our fisheries are depleted. Our forests are almost gone in my area where I live. The whole economy is based on logging. The forests have been stripped bare. It's being clear cut and logged to bare dirt at this point. And they're talking about, what do we do about jobs? Well, my question is this. Has not all of our prosperity, is it not based on natural resources? And since the natural resources are like 90% depleted, what are we going to do to recreate a Gilded Age? That's my question.
Okay, thank you, Randy.
Look, he's absolutely right. I mean, whether the statistics were right or not, the point is that it doesn't take much to realize the degree to which we've been, you know, raping the planet, and it doesn't take much to realize what, even when you look at not just the areas of forests and landscapes, but even go into urban areas where you can see the way in which the environment's been ravaged. The fact is that one of the things about the Roosevelt administration is, and this was fundamental to Roosevelt's mind, I mean, he was absolutely committed to agriculture and absolutely committed to the environment, is, keep in mind, one of the first things it created was the CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps. This was a major environmental initiative, which involved planting, I think it was, my figures may be off, 2 billion trees. I mean, there's a way of engaging young people, for a start, in trying to replenish the environment instead of trying to merely harness it to our own immediate greed and gratification. And I think I think if one looks closely at Sanders, he's got an idea that basically, as if I'm pitching Sanders, but I think there are folks who are literally calling out to Americans and receiving a progressive response, who are saying there are ways of enabling people to work productively and smartly, and also at the same time do our damnedest to recover the better part of American, if you like, the American environment. I mean, I think it's possible. And if I don't think it's, by the way, if that's not possible, then we might as well give up on all of it and all of us start buying stock, I suppose, for the short term. but seriously speaking, the Roosevelt administration, for whatever its failings were in this regard, whatever mistakes were made along the way, by way of damming up rivers or otherwise, the fact is that at that time they were pursuing initiatives with not only the economy, but also with the environment in mind.
I don't think there's any question that they had a much greater vision. Let me remind our listeners one more time. You're listening to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Professor Harvey J.K. is with us on the phone. And we're discussing American history, focusing mostly on the New Deal and what the importance of that era is for us today, what that historic lesson is that we need to learn. Our number here in the studio is 530-337-1885, 530-337-1885. We invite your questions. Call in. Go ahead.
There was just something I wanted to say, and it's often the case that, of course, it sounds like I've written a book in defense of the Roosevelt years, which I in some ways did, but also not simply in defense, but also to enable us to remember what we're capable of doing. But one of the critical things, and this is one of the things that why I'm so pleased with what I see happening around the country right now, is that what really made you go right down the line, Washington, Lincoln, and Roosevelt, the three greatest presidents, great. It's not just that they may well have been smart, you know, smart guys. It's the fact is that Americans pushed them further than they ever would have gone themselves as leaders. I mean, if you think about Lincoln, I mean, you know, we identify Lincoln with the emancipation of the slaves, but we should also remember that African American slaves in the hundreds, in the tens and hundreds of thousands, pretty much were liberating themselves in the South. And it's really when Lincoln realizes the only way to speed up the victory in the war, and perhaps guarantee the victory in the war over the Confederacy, is to, in essence, emancipate or liberate slaves who are already, you know, marching themselves right into Union camps, and then recruiting them into the Union ranks so that by the end of the war there were at least 200,000 African Americans from the South in the Union armies. And indeed, we end up with the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments after the Civil War. Well, similarly with Roosevelt, as much as Roosevelt invited Americans into political action by mobilizing them and empowering them, it's also the case that even before he took office, Americans were beginning to act like Americans. Unions were organizing the unemployed. Farmers up here in the upper Midwest were holding what were called, you know, basically farmer strikes, you know, keeping goods from going to market. They were already challenging the capitalist order. So similarly, we have to ask ourselves, where have we been these last 8 years? Maybe people had so much hope, too much hope, in 2008 that they forgot what really makes America great is not individuals who become president, but the American citizens who push them, who kick their asses.
Well, we've got another caller. I'm not sure if they're ready to come on the line. Yeah, I think they are. And let's take that caller and see what their thoughts are. Pamela, you're on the air.
Well, good morning, Doug, and
good morning.
Good morning, Professor.
Good morning.
I just have one question, then I'll hang up and take my answer on the air. And I thank you so much for coming on KKRN and talking, and it's really good detail and hopeful information. My question is, how do we get the word out more to the public on these issues that you're talking about when we have corporate control of media and educational institutions are starting to be run on the corporate model? That is a problem of, in my opinion, and disinformation. We're not getting what we need to know. Thank you.
Okay.
Good question.
It's a good question. Now, first of all, I'm gonna. This is not simply to patronize you or to compliment you. But seriously speaking, one of the things that's really impressed me, and this is the case in 2005 when my book on Thomas Paine came out, and I got and it had a lot of media attention. I thought, wow, this is going to be great. When the next book comes out, it ought to be that kind of media attention. And in many ways there was, but one of the big differences just in the course of 10 years is that a lot of liberal and left spokespeople, you know, radio folk, have been pushed off the airwaves. I mean, you probably, but mm-hmm. What's interesting is there were two venues, sometimes three, although that was always in trouble perhaps, but three venues that are really crucial. First of all is community radio. You know, I've done community radio shows from Sarasota, Florida, now to where you are, to I did one recently in New Hampshire. And the fact is that, do you do podcasting after this?
Yeah, we put it up on the internet, and then I put it up on public radio exchange, too.
Right. And one of the things people need to do as they're listening to this, and not just for me, but all the shows you do, which I looked at and they're wonderful, is they need to literally get those out by email, by Twitter, by Facebook. I mean, that's grassroots effort. So, first of all, community radio. Next, internet radio. Internet radio seems to be thriving. It's difficult for people to carry on there because, of course, it's another place in which you really have to figure out how you're going to do it without some resources. But internet radio. And third, there are public radio stations that are really quite smart in their shows. So that's for a start, okay? And we lost a major venue for progressive talk this past year when Bill Moyers fully retired from television. He's not retired from public life, but he's retired from television. And I don't know where one goes on TV right now as an alternative. The other thing is there are really good periodicals that need to be supported. The American Prospect, the great progressive magazine, The Nation, In These Times out of Chicago. I don't want to insult anyone if I forget theirs. But these are great, and one really needs to support them. Don't just go online and read articles for free. Support these periodicals. We really do need to get these kinds of ideas out there. Also, communities can create speaker series and bring in the folks, for example, that you, Doug, have talked to over and over again. So it's not going to turn things around all of a sudden, but basically speaking, this is how you build a movement. And we have to start building the movement across lines so that it's not simply a question of Black Lives Matter here and the fight for 15 over there. And, you know, and these things are happening, they're beginning, and although I will say, I think the labor movement itself still is the greatest force we have for progressive change, whatever the folks out there might think about labor movement. I'm a member of two unions, and I believe that labor has got to be the pivotal force. But I think we can do it. And if I didn't think we could do it, I wouldn't write the books, and I wouldn't go talk to you on radio.
Well, and I think the fact that you're putting out those ideas, because so often the dialogue is controlled, especially in corporate television, it's really pitiful. Well, you could look at the GOP debates if you want to, you know, Matt Taibbi called the GOP clown car. I'm nonpartisan, so I'll abuse Hillary just as well. But and she deserves some abuse. And if you're going to run for president, you better be ready to show all your laundry and your baggage.
Yeah,
because
right.
But that aside, I think America is ready for radical empowerment. The youth of today are looking at horrendous debt and no future. We grew up with such fantastic possibilities and opportunities that they don't have. So I think America is ripe for radical action, and I think there's a lot of people that want to go down that road. There were, when you saw Black Lives Matter and all the people that agreed with them shutting down the freeways in Oakland, you had to go, yes, you know, I did. I went, that's people power, and, you know, we can still do the strikes and the unions. I retired out of a union in construction. And, you know, the old union guys, boy, they were pretty militant. There's no question. But and we need that force in America, and we need our leaders like Kissinger and Nixon in the White House, and Nixon being fearful of the anti-war crowd outside. That's the kind of force we need. And,
absolutely. Yeah. In fact, if you look very closely at the Nixon administration, this is, to me, the most wondrous thing. It was a despicable administration, no question. But Nixon knew. He knew the things he could not do because some Americans were mobilized and organized and making a lot of noise. But he also knew that his own generation, that, you know, what we call the greatest generation, those who came through the 30s and the 40s, and we're only now in the 1960s into the 70s, really in middle age, he knew what he could not do. He could not threaten the legacy of that generation, so that he was not going to go after. He was going to go after Social Security. He wasn't even going to go after Medicare and Medicaid. In fact, he proposed, however inadequate the proposal may have been, he proposed a national health care plan. He proposed a basic minimum income for families. I mean, he pursued a series of domestic initiatives, which he didn't even care about and like, probably, but he knew that most Americans expected this of the government that they elected. And, you know, we've now, after all these years, look, you and I at least can remember the 60s. There are young people today who are, you know, rising up in their own fashion, which is wonderful, and I just hope that they can also add a kind of historical imagination and memory to what they're about, because it really would be encouraging to them and empowering, I believe.
Let me remind our listeners one last time. This is the last time to call in on Unspun. Professor Harvey J.K., and we're talking about our history and our future, both at the same time, and their relationship. Call in 337-1885, 337-1885. Well, there's I think I tweeted to you, let's not forget about Eleanor Roosevelt, who was such a great first lady, and the concepts that she even carried forward after Franklin died. I would like you to talk a little bit to that and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and her work.
Yeah, well, I'm not a specialist on the UN and the Declaration of Human Rights, but it is important to know that she grabbed hold of the four freedoms and made that fundamental to the idea of a Universal Declaration of Human Rights. She was extraordinary. It's interesting to note that 75 years ago this year, it was 1940, she published a little book. It's one of her lesser-known works, but it's a really remarkable little book titled The Moral Basis of Democracy. And in this book, and this is a year before Roosevelt himself ever spoke of the four freedoms, she spoke, and she was doing this, by the way, in her speeches around the country, she spoke of four equalities. And I think these four equalities remain an ideal for us to embrace. She said that what we needed to fight for was equality before the law. In other words, justice. Equality of education. I mean, that's that very same ideal that my parents spoke of, which I referred to when I opened this up. Equality of opportunity to earn a living. That is, no exclusion, in other words, by reason of race and creed and color, etc., what they used to say regarding jobs and the workplace. And lastly, and this was in some ways particularly powerful, I believe, because it spoke to the question of Jim Crow and white supremacy in the South, equality to express oneself and participate in government. So, equality before the law, equality of education, equality of opportunity to earn a living, equality to express oneself and participate in freedom. And those four equalities, I think, were at the heart of her thinking from the 1930s all the way through. In fact, let me just say about Eleanor Roosevelt. Franklin Roosevelt was a progressive from the early part of the century as a young politician. But Eleanor did something for him as he was trying to overcome his polio, which was really important. She was working down in New York with the Women's Trade Union League, and she became good friends with a group of socialist immigrant labor organizers, women. And she would bring them back to Hyde Park, and they in essence helped Roosevelt, FDR, to see that a progressive Democrat doesn't only work in terms at the policy and program level, but she has to make sure that policy and program engages working people and empowers them. And I think that was crucial. And I think those insights are what Eleanor Roosevelt helped him to appreciate in the 1920s, so that when he became president, the New Deal was as progressive as it was.
Well, let's think about how that might actually happen in the future. Let's pretend that Bernie Sanders somehow gets a nomination and wins the presidency. Some people believe that it doesn't matter who wins because the war profiteers and the Wall Street bankers run the country. So how would somebody like Bernie Sanders actually be able to turn this around? How do you think that would ever happen in America today?
Well, I mean, let's put it this way. I think we'd see a pretty tumultuous couple of years when he first took office, because Sanders has the kind of historical memory I've been talking about, and that is that he'll remember what FDR was about. He'll create, and let's see if Republicans want to block these kinds of initiatives. He'll create some counterparts of the CCC for young people to become directly involved in either, call it community development, environmental change, climate change being addressed. I'm convinced he's going to do this, and you're going to see a tremendous amount of energy coming out of high schools and colleges. And let's see to what extent the Republicans and others are going to try to oppose this kind of dynamic. I also think that I hope that he's attentive to the fact that it isn't just a matter of trying to pass legislation, which may well be blocked, in order to make union organizing all the more possible. I think he's likely going to invite labor to come and occupy the National Mall in some kind of massive demonstration, occupy public spaces, to take the Tea Party and turn it upside down, you might say. I mean, I think that Bernie Sanders is about that. But I also think he's going to figure out a way to split the ranks of big business, because he learned when he became mayor of Burlington back in the 70s how to engage the business community in community development. I think people maybe underestimate him, because they think about him as this independent turned Democrat, this democratic socialist or social democrat in Congress who's never really been in a position to enact legislation. But don't forget, he started out as a mayor of a city and helped turn that city around, Burlington, Vermont.
Okay, well, we have that to look forward to as a scenario, and as you know, trying to be hopeful, looking forward. One last question, and I want you to put yourself in Franklin Delano Roosevelt's shoes and pretend if he were alive today, what would he say to the American people?
He'd say, "What would he say?"
Yeah,
he'd say, "Well, one possibility just popped into my head is you have nothing to fear but fear itself." Okay, how's that?
And that would include ISIS, right? I think he wouldn't fear ISIS. Well, who would?
I don't think he would either.
I don't think so. Why should we? Yeah.
So we may disagree on the imperative of what to do, but nevertheless, I think, look, when he said we have nothing to fear but fear itself, he knew there was good reason to fear, but he also knew that fear in itself would not necessarily bring the millennium either.
Well, yes. And what else? We've still got a few.
Well, the other thing is, I think he would try to remind Americans, as I'm, you know, I hope in some ways that I'm speaking on behalf of a generation and a president of the past that has so much to say to today. I think he'd say, look, this country from its founding may not have lived up to the ideals we set for ourselves. We have a history filled with tragedy and irony, a history filled with exploitation and oppression. But Americans have never allowed those things to deter them from pursuing the four freedoms: freedom of speech and expression, freedom of worship, and even the decision to not worship at all if you like, freedom from want, and freedom from fear. And I don't think you can do better than those in a democratic society.
Well, especially if you look at what he meant from about, you know, freedom from want is a little vague, but what he said in those in that second Bill of Rights that he was promoting,
mm-hmm.
I think those things we're still struggling for, most Americans want. So that's a great message, and we have about a minute and a half. Now that you've spoken for FDR, have you got anything to say that you'd like to add personally that maybe we've left out here? You'll hear a little music in the background.
You know, I want to say I've lived in Wisconsin now for more than half my life, and I can tell you that I ache and I agonize over what I've seen Scott Walker and the Republicans do to this state. Okay, this was the great small p, sometimes capital P, progressive state. I know we produced the likes of McCarthy long before I ever got here, but this was also the state that had as its senators Herb Kohl and especially Russ Feingold. And what gives me hope is that we now have Tammy Baldwin, who got elected at the darkest moments of Wisconsin political history, nevertheless a progressive lesbian senator from Wisconsin. And now we've got Russ Feingold running again, and I think we're going to redeem this state, and I think we can redeem the nation.
Well, I love that hopeful thought, and I'm with you there. I think it's possible. I hope that the youngsters wake up and understand that for their own sake, they need to get involved and active, and I'm with you there. So we both have hope about the future of America in that sense.
Last line, more power to community radio.
Okay, I'm all for that. And you know, some of your things that you were talking about are actually in the works. Speakers,
right.
Tours. In fact, I've done one myself with Ray McGovern all over the North State. So it's very possible. Well, there's our music. That's our cue to end the show. I want to thank you very much, Professor Harvey J.K.
Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.
Again, Harvey J.K. on Twitter, anybody interested.
That's right. And I'll put all those links and your Twitter account name on there, too, so they can get a hold of you. Thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, you've been listening to Unspun, an experiment of truth-telling on KKRN Community Radio. Our guest today has been Professor Harvey J.K., Professor of Democracy and Justice Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay, award-winning author. Professor K. has published 15 books, History, Politics, Ideas. You can follow him at Harvey J.K. on Twitter. I will put links to his websites, books, and articles on kkrn.org, along with the archives of this show. And you can find them at kkrn.com/shows/unspun. Next week on Unspun, Pamela Spoto from Late Night Poetry Jam will be co-hosting with me. We'll be talking with Professor Michael Coyle from the Political Science Department of the California State University in Chico. We'll be discussing our so-called criminal justice system, that word justice. Listen in next Saturday, 9 a.m. Pacific, for another dose of Unspun and Experiment Truth Telling. Thank you for listening. Next up on KKRN, Peace Talks Radio.